Good morning. Welcome to Senate Finance. Today is Thursday, February 2nd, 2017. The time is, my clock's advancing too quickly. 9:02 a.m. I'm Co-Chairman Anna McKinnon. Joining me at the table this morning, Co-Chairman Hoffman.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Vice Chairman Bishop.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Dunleavy.
Good morning.
Senator Olson.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Machicki.
Morning.
On today's agenda, we have a presentation from the administration. Commissioner Fisher will be talking to us about the PERS, TERS liability. If you recall yesterday, I asked you to hold your questions to contracts and others. We received the presentation yesterday, and it is on what our questions were on yesterday, on the actual liability itself. So please feel free to ask those questions that we were talking about yesterday. Is there any other business to come before the committee before we begin? Senator Dunleavy.
Madam Chair, thank you. I just want to correct the mistake I made on the floor yesterday. You see a row of fine-looking young folks here in front of us, and they are with American Charter, which is a fantastic charter school up in the Meadow Lakes area of the Valley. Up in the parks by Pittman is where it's located. They've been down here the last several days to understand the political and legislative process. And their principal is related to somebody that we all knew, and that is Mrs. Huggins, Senator Huggins' wife, is the principal of their school. So with that, I once again want to correct my mistake. We have a lot of fine charter schools in the Valley, and it's a pleasure to have these folks down here and these young people with us. So thanks for coming.
Welcome to Senate Finance. For those joining us off-net or online, we're in Alaska's capital, Juneau, Alaska, in room 532. Commissioner Fisher, are you here? If you would join us at the microphone, introduce yourself and others, and then since there's two voices that are both male, if we could, for the Secretary's benefit, if you change between the two of you talking, if you could identify yourself before you speak so our secretaries have a clear recording.
Thank you. My name is Sheldon Fisher. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Administration, and I'm pleased to have the opportunity to come and present today. You have a presentation in front of you on the screen, and I'll just walk through. I thought I would move relatively quickly through the early slides, but pause if there's questions, and then we'll slow down as we talk about some of the financial information that I think will be of interest. Organizationally, I think many people know, but for the benefit of all, our PERS and TERS are managed through the Alaska Retirement Management Board. That board doesn't really have a staff in and of itself. The staff is provided by the Department of Revenue and the Department of Administration. The Department of Revenue is focused primarily on the investment of the assets, and they work with our investment consultant Callan, and the Department of Administration is focused on the administration of the benefits, and we work with the actuary staff and make that information available to the ARM board. Moving then to slide four, just to provide a little bit of the chronology. As I think many of you know, in the past we had various tiers of defined benefit programs. The final Tier 3 closed in 2006 when the legislature initiated Tier 4, which is no longer a defined benefit plan, but a defined contribution. What that means is, under a defined benefit, as the name implies, the members are guaranteed a particular benefit that is defined by the plan. Under Tier 4, the members are assured a particular contribution, a defined contribution, and then the benefit they receive will depend on the returns that they're able to achieve, and the member has materially greater control over the investments and how that is managed. And then we'll talk a little bit more, but in 2008, the state accepted to fund part of the cost of the plan. And we've got some slides on this later on, but as the past service amount, the unfunded liability grew, and the obligation on employers was becoming a challenge. The state took on some of the funding of that in 2008. Moving to slide five, sometimes there's a question about the percentage of employees that are in each of the tiers, the defined benefit versus the defined contribution, and you can see that we now have more defined contribution employees in the defined contribution plan than in the defined benefit plans. This changed in about 2015.
Commissioner Fisher, we do have a question. Senator Michicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Fisher, I will have several questions, but one of the things I'm going to want to do is do some research about what it looks like everywhere else. And you probably have those spreadsheets of what other states, kind of what the average is for cost per capita and what kinds of plans and how they've managed some of that liability through the years. But I will have more more exact questions that I'll probably send in an email that perhaps you can provide, but just in a general sense.
So we can respond. I don't have an exact split between states. And if I'm understanding, just some general, most states have gone away from a defined benefit program. Far and away, most states have a defined contribution or what sometimes is referred to as hybrid plans, where a portion of the benefit may be a defined benefit and a portion of it is a defined contribution. And so they will kind of split that liability and the risk. There are actually some benefits associated with a defined benefit plan, and it's something that we could come back and talk more about. And what I mean by benefits is it results in a more efficient use of the capital. One of the largest issues is that an individual over their lifetime, as they approach retirement, they move out of the higher returning but more volatile asset classes and move into a more conservative asset allocation, which lowers their return. And so that's the reason why some states, that's one of the reasons why some states have gone to hybrid plans, to try to maximize the return but minimize the risk to the state. Yeah, I don't know if that's helpful, but if you will give us questions, we'll be happy to provide the information.
Senator Michicki, follow-up?
Just a quick follow-up. Yeah, I'm kind of more interested in the cost per capita per state, their future exposure, and how they look at that unfunded liability. I mean, I don't know if we're in the ballpark of other states or we're an extreme outlier with our unfunded liability and future exposure. So that's kind of more the way that I was going.
So through the chair, let me just talk a couple of points there. You'll see a little bit later on, our plans are close to 80%. So our PERS plan is funded at about 78%. Our TERS plan is about 72% or 82%. The average funding for public plans is about 74.5%, I think. And so we're a little bit above average. There's only two plans in the country that are fully funded, and that's, I believe it's North Dakota, maybe it's South Dakota, and Wisconsin. The best plans in the country are about 90% funded. And so we are above average in terms of our funding level, but not as good as maybe the top 10%. One fact that may be of interest that kind of goes to your question, if you take our unfunded liability on a per capita basis, we're kind of among the highest in the country. That, I think, may go to a little bit of your question. I think you know, I should say for the benefit of everyone, from time to time people ask why we can't. They hear other states going through a reform in terms of the level of benefits that are offered to retirees. Our Constitution protects the retirees from a diminishment, and so there are some guidelines around it in that the Supreme Court has defined, but as a general matter, it's very difficult for us to reduce benefits to retirees, and hence you see these tiers. They'll close a tier, and then everyone hired after that date comes into a different plan.
Thank you. Commissioner, yesterday we had an analysis before us on the from our debt manager. And so in reflecting to credit rating agencies in our nation, we had a little bit different conversation, and there was quite a bit of curiosity at this table, quite a bit of high-level interest with what I described as the elephant in the room as we talk about the $3 billion deficit for our annual budgeting that we are required to do by our Constitution, but this huge unfunded liability that will just roll right over the top of that if we don't start addressing it. And this team wanted to ask those questions, and please ask those questions today. But on the slide that we had yesterday, it was just under the debt manager, we described the systems in PERS and TERS for 2015, not 16, at a 67% funding ratio, improved from over 2014, and a TERS funding ratio of 76.9%. That was after the reflection of the $3 billion. And so my question is, the numbers that you just gave us a few minutes ago, and if you could restate the PERS, I heard you say we were 82% funded on the TERS. And I'm wondering if you've blended the numbers between the health portion of the liability and the retirement system liability, or how should I understand and sort of blend these two statements that are different together?
So I've accelerated to slide 17, if that's okay, in the presentation. And what you see there is, and I'll just kind of go through the detail, and hopefully this is responsive. If you go back to 2014, under PERS, the pension liability was 59.7, and with the $3 billion, $1 billion was contributed to PERS. So with that additional $1 billion of contribution, that increased to about 67%. But then you see also between those years an improvement in our defined benefit health care unfunded liability, where we went from 87% to nearly 100% in health care. And that is was the result of our experience actually better than what the actuaries had forecasted. And so I think that's a combination. I believe that the actuaries had been using a fairly conservative set of assumptions. And then the department has been working to try to better manage healthcare growth, and so we improved as well on what trend had been. And so the 78% is a blend, to respond directly to your question, it is a blend between the pension and the healthcare liability for a total.
Commissioner, we just wanted to make sure that those Alaskans that are following, we had different numbers yesterday, and they were split. And one of the questions that we wanted to ask you today with the blended rate number is exactly why the health number was more funded in its entirety versus the pension side of the house. And you did just explain that it was because of some of the beating some of the criteria that the actuaries used to project forward. I was wondering specifically yesterday, was if there was any kind of a split in the $3 billion deposit. You know, we said where it should go, the PERS system, the TERS system, but then did the ARM board, you gave the description, the Alaska Retirement Management Board, did they split that further into health, or was it just all realized savings from your actuary assumptions?
Thank you. A modest amount went into health. So of the $3 billion, $1 billion went into PERS, and all of that went into the pension. The $2 billion that went into TERS, about $1.67 billion went into the pension, and about $330 million went into health. And I can give you the precise numbers. Those are close, but it was the TERS was $1,662,700,000 went into pension, and $337,330,000 went into healthcare. So Out of the $3 billion, a little bit more than 10% went to the health care, and that was all in TERS.
If I could, and we do have senators backing up, so I'll yield, but that was then an internal determination of the ARM board, the management board, to place the $330 million into the health portion of the trust versus the pension side of the house.
Yes, that was based on a recommendation from the actuary, and the ARM board adopted that.
Senator Von Himhoff.
Thank you for this. So looking again on 17, this is in 2015, I believe this is a point in time in terms of the funded ratio. It changes each year as the liabilities and actuarials change. So I have not looked ahead, but I'm assuming in the next slide is that it's going to tell us. Do you have a slide in the future that shows us how those funding ratios dip?
So we don't, but I did want to kind of highlight the risk that we're facing. And let me talk a little bit about why we're using 15 numbers. We're in 17 using 15 numbers. So our fiscal year ends with the state's fiscal year in June. The actuary then goes through a process to take the financial statements and produce a valuation, which then gets presented to the ARM board in their March meeting. And so we're using 615 numbers March. The 616 numbers will be presented to the ARM board, and we can, at that point, we'll have a roll forward of this data. The point, I guess, I would make and share with you. We periodically, every 4 or 5 years, the ARM board and the actuaries go through a fairly detailed review of all the assumptions. And we're going to be doing that this year. And I guess I don't want to prejudge what will come out of that, but I think there's more risk that our unfunded liability will grow than opportunity that will shrink. And the reason I say that is we are, the ARM board is operating today with a return assumption of 8%. That is kind of on the high end of pension plans. I mean, it's not unheard of. Many other plans have a similar assumption, but there's been ongoing discussion within the ARM board about whether or not that should be reduced, and I expect a healthy conversation on that topic in the coming months. To put it in perspective, I reviewed an analysis from about a year ago. The average of a year ago was about 7.6% was the average return assumption for public pension funds. So we are a little bit above average. There's no pension plan with an assumption higher than 8%. So that's one risk to the numbers we're showing you. We will be reviewing the mortality rate, and it's been 4 or 5 years since we reviewed that before, and so there may be some modification to those assumptions that as people live longer, then, of course, our obligations grow. A few others that are probably less impactful, but the size of state government. As state government shrinks, there's fewer people to contribute. That doesn't really address the unfunded liability, but it does address the contribution ratio. If there's fewer employees, then that contribution ratio may grow. So I guess I just want to sensitize the legislature that there are these numbers are accurate as of 2015, but there is risk that the unfunded liability or that the state assistance will grow, and we've got some slides that will kind of talk a little bit about that.
Follow up, Senator Von Imhoff.
Eventually, I'd like to see an actuarial liability valuation versus the market value valuation, because I know that those are change, and it's nice to see what the gap is.
So, through the chair, forgive me, I want to make sure I'm understanding the question. We, the way the actuary treats the assets is they smooth them over a 5-year period, but it may be a 4-year period,
five-year
period. And that's we've been advised that's best practices, and it kind of minimizes the volatility. It allows the legislature to, I think, have more consistency in the state assistance payment. Are you asking, would you like to see what the unsmoothed asset valuation number, is that your question?
I will have to think about that and perhaps have a conversation where we can clarify that.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, good morning. I'm going to go back to your just previous comments about going forward, the number of participants coming down because of you know, budget cuts, attrition, et cetera. So 44% actives in the DB plan and 56% actives in the DC plan. So the DC contributions, are they isolated just in DC? So and the DB plan contributions go to DB?
I'm going the wrong way. I'm going to take you to another slide. So
we were on slide 5 that had the basic facts on membership and PERS.
Okay, so here are the contribution rates for defined benefit and for defined contribution. So as you look at the defined contribution side, you see that an employee makes an 8% contribution and the employer makes something in the neighborhood of between 5.25% and 5.75%. And the range is that 0.49% there, that is the occupational death and disability contribution for peace officers and firefighters. And so there's a higher contribution made for those occupations. But so these contributions are made on by the employer on behalf of the employee, and then everything above those contributions, the difference between that and the 22%, is a contribution that the state makes to cover this unfunded liability and this debt that's outstanding. Does that?
No.
Okay, forgive me.
Or maybe I just didn't get what you said. My point being, the people that are still in tiers 1 through 3, they're funding the DB plan. Their contributions are going into that plan, right?
That's correct, yes.
And the DC contributions, are they warehoused in another subset? And they are, so are the funds commingled, the DC contributions and the DB contributions?
Through the chair. So the state pays 22% mm-hmm. for every employee, whether they're DB or DC. And the contributions that you see on the page are segregated for those DC members, but the difference between the 22% and these contributions on the page then is contributed to the DB plan to cover that cost. So a portion of it is commingled, and a portion of it is segregated.
Okay. So I won't – thank you, Madam Chair. I won't go any deeper. We'll have a private conversation because, to his earlier question, if you're going to respond to Senator Machicki, I'd like you to research Nebraska's hybrid plan. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Bishop. Two things. First, on the topic on slide 6, as I understand it, the employer is paying the 22%. So PERS has state employees as well as employees contributing from across the state. And there was a concern as far as the blending goes with the costs that were being charged. But the state is picking up for all of those other communities above the 22% and has been for some time, and that there would be potential if we defined the contribution at a lower rate that there could be discrimination against an employee who came that had defined benefits versus defined contributions. So the problem is more complex than the dollar amount following, because those employers across the state that own about 40% of our liability, or used to, have not paid, from some's perspective, their fair share of digging us out of the liability. So It's complex. I'll let Senator Bishop and Senator Machicki take that conversation to the administration to look for further clarity. I would like to acknowledge that former Speaker of the House, Mike Bradner, has been with us for some time. Good morning. Welcome. As well as OMB Director Pat Pitney. So I just wanted to thank you both for your service today and before today. Commissioner, Senator Machicki, did you have a question?
I do not, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Commissioner Fisher, and you are joined today by Kevin Worley, the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Administration. Kevin, welcome.
Thank you.
Commissioner, please continue.
Thank you. Again, I've touched on this slide six. I guess the only other thing I would call out, and this highlights something that the chair just mentioned, the employer, under the defined benefit, the employer contribution is 22%. That is fixed by statute. The state then covers the gap between what is really required to fund it versus that 22%, and at this time it's a little bit over 4% of additional state that the on behalf payment consists, it constitutes that 4%.
Senator Bishop?
Yes, and thank you, Madam Chair. And I think this is you might have segued right into another concern, if you will, on your description, and that goes along the lines of the termination study. So that's debatable, so I just wanted to see if want to keep that in mind, too, because there's people that, employers that have came to us saying, we're Johnny's gone, but I'm still carrying the mail for Johnny, and Johnny's over here working for another entity that's, it's like he's being doubled up on, and I can understand some of those communities' concerns, so thank you.
Commissioner Fisher, did you have a response to that on the termination study? If not, I have Senator Machicki waiting in the queue.
Termination studies are a complex subject, and the issue is that the employer, in essence, has a share of this unfunded liability that needs to be serviced, and if they make radical changes to their structure, then there needs to be some sort of an accounting of that that share of the unfunded liability. There are a number of issues, and we would be pleased to come back and talk about that. It does impose, particularly on smaller municipalities, it makes it difficult for them to right-size because of that. And the administration in the past has supported the concept of thinking through some sort of reform to termination studies. To go to the specific question that you have raised, which is part of the way the termination liability is calculated assumes that a person leaves state employment, and there's and if they were to say they left a municipality and went to work for another municipality or went to work for the state, so they're still in the system, then it's a fair point that there is it may be appropriate to make an adjustment. And this is something that's come to my attention even in the last week, and we are prepared to kind of examine if that makes a material difference. We can kind of have that conversation and look at whether an adjustment is appropriate.
Thank you, Madam
Chair. Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Fisher, can you please describe the benefit under the defined contribution side that covers occupational death and disability for peace officers and firefighters? It's a common theme to some discussions going on last year and this year.
So the benefit that is provided here is a pension or a salary replacement benefit. It is, and it offers a 40% salary replacement. The discussion that at least I'm aware of that has been so a part of our our discussion in the last couple of years has been the health care, and that is not provided in the defined contribution. And so there's no, while there's a salary replacement portion, there's no health care provided, and that's what I think many have asked, whether there should be health care offered for the survivors.
Madam Chair, follow-up.
Senator Machicki.
So we are able to, in this case, under the state defined contribution plan, have a separate category for peace officers and firefighters that is related to a salary replacement.
Through the chair, yes. And we could also for health care.
Interesting. Thank you.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, as you look at some of the, since we're talking about termination, what happens when you have a community or something that wants to go ahead and get out of the PERS situation? We have a specific community in my district, Galena, who has got a decrease in population, certainly has decreased revenues related to municipal sales tax and things like that. What options do we have out there for them to try and make it so that they can stay solvent?
Through the chair, so that's a perfect example of the place where we would like to work with the legislature to provide options for those kind of communities. I don't think it's helpful for the system or for the community to burden them, and so and it would be a relatively modest amount. So that's a topic that the administration has expressed a willingness to review, but. Our interpretation is it would require a change in statute to be able to accommodate that.
Last question, Madam Chair, has to do with, so you're saying the department cannot do anything about it. There needs to be a real statute change to it in order for them to be affected in a positive way.
Through the chair, that is our analysis.
No,
yes.
Further question, Madam Chair.
On behalf of a community that I represent, they've approached the legislature for a termination study. Also, or the elimination of the termination study. And so it's a problem for large cities, too, to try to reduce. And there's an issue of equity if we start calling out people that don't have to pay for their liabilities and require those in other areas that have taxing authorities to have to do it. So it's a huge issue for Alaska in all areas of our government, where there are groups of people that have the ability to pay and those that don't.
I agree, Madam Chair. It's a complicated topic.
Mr. Fisher, anything else on slide 6?
No, I'm going to move along. And much of what you see here, and given kind of the time we've spent and I think the tenor of your questions, I'm going to flip pretty quickly. On slide 8, you see a similar chronology for TERS. On slide 9, you see the split for TERS, which also you can see there's, well, forgive me, TERS is not quite flipped. We're about 50-50, slightly more DB members, but we expect in the coming few years that will flip over as well. And then on slide 10, you see a similar schedule of contributions, and all of the things that we talked about are consistent. I guess the one thing I would say is that the employer contribution in PERS is 22%, in TERS it's 12.56, and so that's a fairly meaningful distinction between the twos and the two plans in terms of the employer's obligation.
Senator Dunleavy, did you have a question?
Yes, through the chair, can you explain to the public why the folks in TERS are not in the Social Security system since the 50s? I get that question every now and then. Why are they excluded from that?
So Social Security has the ability for state entities, if they want, if they desire, to opt out of Social Security and replace it with a comparable system. And so in the state back at that time made that election, and so rather than making those contributions into Social Security, they're making those contributions into this retirement plan. And I would say that I think that was a wise decision, the kind of return that we're able to generate as a state and through the investments is meaningfully better than the kind of return a person would get with an equal contribution into Social Security.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. Senator Von Imhoff.
I, too, get that same question. And I do know in my paycheck, privately, I make a contribution each month to a 401k and to Social Security. Has there been discussion about perhaps doing something similar in reintroducing Social Security and having that be a secondary retirement plan?
Commissioner Fisher.
Through the chair. So on the PERS side, at least for state employees, this is not true for every employer, but we also have SBS, a supplemental benefit, and that is exactly like the contribution made to Social Security. So it's the 6.13, I think, is the number up to the cap of Social Security. I believe that it's $117,500 a year. And so the employer makes their half of that contribution. The employee makes their half of that contribution. And, again, that goes into their defined contribution account. It vests over a period of time and is available for them to manage and invest as they would their other assets. And so to my knowledge, there's never been a discussion about going back and including Social Security, but personally I would think that would be a step backwards. I think that what we offer our employees today, at least to the state, is a superior product. On the TERS side, so the SBS is not available to the teachers, but there is a slightly higher contribution from the employers, and to my knowledge, there's not been a conversation about going back to some sort of a Social Security or supplemental.
Commissioner, could you please, this is Senator McKinnon, could you please check and make sure that that's even an option? As I understood reviewing those rules, there's a question whether that's even an option once you've gotten into the system. Otherwise, you would have to make whole the entire life of the employee's work history with either the state or the TERS level. So I had thought when that discussion was happening, that it was a one-time option. You're staying with the system or you're pulling out. So maybe we need to clarify that before we go very far down the road. But I don't want to raise expectations with the public that we can start a conversation about a system that is not solvent right now to moving from one that is fairly solvent. So you said it may be a step backwards, but I don't even know if it's legally possible.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You're correct. There may be some tactics of ways that you could combine systems, but for an existing system, you're absolutely right. It's not legally available to do that.
Senator Von Imhoff, any follow-up?
No, I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Senator Machicki.
All right, moving then, we're going to talk about financial information, and much of this we have already touched on, but I would just remind people that we're looking at June 30, 2015 numbers. The June 30, 2016 numbers will be available in about a month, and as I touched on earlier, the ARM board and the actuaries will be going through a fairly detailed review of all assumptions that may impact some of the underlying numbers as well. So, again, on slide 12, this is, in essence, the information we saw before. Again, it is both pension and health. You see that we have assets on the pension side of about $16 billion with liabilities of about $20.5 billion, so an unfunded liability of about $4.5 billion. That is on the PERS side, and then on the TERS side, we've got, again, assets of about $8 billion, liabilities of about $9.7 billion for an unfunded liability of about $1.6 billion. So, that reflects the 73% funded for PERS and the 83% funded for TERS.
Commissioner Fisher, just for clarity, that's a blended with the health care. I can see that on the slides, but I just wanted to call that out, that that's a blended unfunded liability of about $5.5 billion. Is that accurate?
I think it's about, yes, for PERS, yes. It's, well, on a combined basis, it's about $6.1 billion.
Thank you. And we believe 8% is the high assumption that may need to be reviewed or that the ARM board continues to talk about. I know we have historical data that supports that we have achieved over a 30-year time period the 8% return, but that tends to be on the higher end of what pension plans are operating on now. Is that accurate?
Madam Chair, that is accurate. The one thing I guess I would also say, however, is that our inflation assumptions that are in the model, in the actuarial model, are at 3%, and based on at least the last few years, we've been in a low return, but also a low inflationary period. And so that is kind of the logic that the ARM board has used to be comfortable maintaining the current assumptions. But as I say, this is all going to be revisited in the coming year.
Commissioner Fisher, are we going to get to some cash flow assumptions?
Yes.
So I'll hold my question then.
So on slide 13, you can see the return assumptions, and as the chair mentioned, long term the plan has averaged nearly 9% return, but the more recent returns have been obviously less. On slide 14, just to this probably is understood, but just to kind of put it on a page. Kind of the way the unfunded liability arises, if the contributions that are made plus the earnings on the investment, ideally they would equal the benefits that are paid out to the retirees plus the expenses of administering the fund and the plan. If they're accurate, there's no unfunded liability. If they're not accurate, if there's some disruption or if the assumptions prove not to be accurate, then the unfunded liability is created.
Commissioner Fisher, that can be the reverse also. There was a point in time that our system, I believe, was at least reported to be overfunded, and we reduced our contributions. Is that accurate?
Yes, it is.
Do you recall what years that?
I'll show you. I think I've got.
I can hold. Senator Machicki.
Actually, so Commissioner Fisher, you may have meant to make that statement, but I believe what did you mean to say that if assumptions are accurate, that our own unfunded liability remains at only $6 billion, and if our unfunded our investment earnings drop below the 8%, then our unfunded liability increases, not as created. Is that correct?
What through the chair? Yes, I would agree with your characterization that as the investment assumption declines, the unfunded liability will grow. If that's
Senator Machicki,
but at 8%, $6 billion in unfunded liability remains
as of June 30, 2015.
Thank you.
Commissioner Fisher, as a follow-up to Senator Machicki, would it continue at an 8% assumption rate if we actually achieved the 8%? So what I heard in a question from Senator Machicki is, if all things remain equal and we achieve an 8%, we will still have a $6.1 billion unfunded liability. Is that accurate, or if we achieve an 8% rate of return, will it start digging down on the unfunded liability based on returns and our continued contributions at the 22%?
Madam Chair, so the unfunded liability of the $6.1 billion assumes that we achieve an 8% return over the duration of the fund. the remaining life of the fund. And so that over time, that unfunded liability will change as retirees grow and as expenses are paid and retirees pass away and the plan winds down. And so, but that liability is as of 6/30/15 assumes an 8% return for the duration of the fund.
Thank you. Hence the problem twice as big as the one we're facing with the operating budget. Senator Machicki.
Madam Chair and Commissioner Fisher, I'm going to kind of call your attention. I'll share this with you later, but this demonstrates that state payments will increase even if you reach the 8%, which is kind of my point for this. It's if the public is reviewing this slide, they might have the impression that there's not an existing unfunded liability even if we're successful at 8%, which is why I think it's – and I know you and know that you don't mean to be misleading, but this slide can be a bit misleading.
Thank you. We'll revise this to be more careful. Thank you. This slide 15 shows the history of the state assistance payments. And as you can see, since 2006, the state has made contributions of in excess of $6.7 billion into the fund. $3 billion of that was associated with, obviously, the 2015 contribution. The other thing that the plan did and the legislature did in associated with that 2015 contribution is they extended the amortization another 9 years. And so you see in 2014, the state made a contribution of nearly $630 million. And afterwards, it dropped down to about $256 million. And that was the result of both the $3 billion contribution plus an extension of the amortization. Going forward, and we don't have a slide on this, but the contributions continue to grow. Well, this year we're forecasting about $185 million, but it will grow and actually in the out years will be in excess of $450 million is what we project.
Senator Machicki.
Madam Chair, Mr. Fisher, can you discuss the relationship on how extending our amortization, although it is extremely beneficial to the state, I kind of explained that we turned a 30-year loan into a 15-year loan, right?
Right.
But the adverse effect was that we increased the payments to the municipalities. We heard that somewhat, and just as we look forward on how to solve some of these problems, I'm not sure that everyone's aware about that relationship. Municipalities are. I'm not sure that everyone in the building is, however.
Through the chair, your characterization is accurate. So it is like we went from a 15-year mortgage to a 30-year mortgage. That reduced the amount, the annual payment each year. But because the municipalities were not just the municipalities, because employers, and the state is also an employer, because employers are capped in their contribution at 22% under PERS, by extending it, they continue to pay that 22% from a municipality perspective, they were going to pay 22% for 16 years. Now they're going to take 22% for 25 years. And that's therein is the additional obligation that change imposed upon them.
Senator Dunleavy, did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair. You said something about payments in the outer years would be 400 and some million plus. Can you repeat that and just clarify that for me, please?
So over time, as individuals retire, then the expenses grow, and this state assistance payment will grow with that. And so, we can pick a year. I can provide a schedule to you, but our forecast that is, for example, in 2027, we would forecast there would be about a $450 million state assistance payment.
And is that in relationship to the graph that Senator Machicki was showing?
I'll have to look at that graph. I don't know.
I think that's important because that's going to be payments we need to make out of the general fund going forward, is what you're saying.
Yes, that's right.
That's a huge chunk of change.
Senator Dunleavy, if I could pause for just a moment. We're going to need to take a copy of Senator Machicki's slide. It's been referred to twice now in the record. So we'll, if I could get the Senate secretaries to copy it so that we could get the slide referenced so that we have it available to the public.
Madam Chair, that's a slide from yesterday's presentation.
Thank you. Which slide number do we know?
I'm sorry, it's slide 17.
So slide 17 from yesterday's. We'll still take a copy of it so that our secretaries have it for today's meeting. Brief at ease. We're back on the record. We have copied and should have uploaded the graph that is being referred to in the conversation. Senator Dunleavy, a follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just everyone's got the graph, and Senator Machicki had shown that earlier in the conversation. But, Commissioner, can you just explain the out year of 39 or 2039 is roughly about $880 million we would be making payments on?
Through the chair, the schedule I have didn't go all the way out to 2039, but I assume that these numbers are correct, and that kind of upper blue portion does reflect the state assistance payment. And in nominal dollars in 2039, it would be the $880 million that you referred. I think it may be $870 or something. But it is important to recognize that that is that's not in today's dollars. That is in future dollars. And with if we were to discount it back, it would be something less. And I don't know what that number would be, but we could.
Thank you, Commissioner Fisher. Senator Machicki?
Just to explain that a little better for the public that may not follow these numbers every day. I mean, essentially what you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that this curve would be relatively flat if adjusted to today's dollars.
Through the chair, it would be less steep. I don't know what the exact shape would be, but it would be less steep.
Mr. Fisher, thank you. Senator Dunleavy.
Probably somewhere in the area of $500 million going out.
All things being equal, it's probably a guess.
Yeah, right.
So the for the general public, we're looking at a slide that has a 17 in the lower left-hand corner that says bonds reimbursement, and statutory UAAL debt as the header. And so we've entered that into the record for today's conversation, and I think it's fair to state that there is a huge unfunded liability in a payment that will be called for, as Senator Dunleavy is describing, as maybe in the neighborhood of $500 million. I just don't want people to go away when we don't actually know the number. We are guessing right now. This slide reflects nominal dollars, which the commissioner has said may overstate it from today's perspective as to what that high-level number reflected on this graph of around just under $800 million of a cash call payment. And for those that were around, Senator Machicki, Senator Dunleavy, that is why $3 billion was invested into the unfunded liability to try to drive that down. We were looking at just a few years back of a cash call on this debt of almost $1 billion. That is why we put $3 billion in today. And we are trying to get, or I'm waiting to get to the conversation of cash call beyond the payment side, but the liquidity inside of the fund itself to meet the needs of those state employees, those municipal employees, those local government employees from villages that are anticipating a pension from their employer. And this is a issue for all of us to be very mindful of, as I know that you are in this committee. And the reason I'm concerned about the cash call in a given date and time is because if you're the one waiting for that check to come, it's very important to you that you receive it. That's how you've planned your retirement. And if the state is unable to make that cash call because it's having to sell off assets that are yielding high returns, like a apartment complex or a commercial piece of property because of cash flow, this committee needs to know that sooner rather than later. And Commissioner, that's why, you know, I look to 30 years reflectively saying we've made an 8% rate of return, but we do that with a portfolio that has asset allocations that have literally foundations and footing sunk into the ground. And if we start selling those off, our rates of return, depending on the allocation and what's successful, we could hurt ourselves further, just like we've done in drawing down over $10 billion worth of assets that could have contributed right now from an interest earning perspective to help solve the fiscal issues that we're facing today. Senators, have I stated that fairly for those that have been around? I'm seeing senators nod their head yes. I don't mean to get on a soapbox and preach to the choir, because I know every senator at this table understands this issue well. Commissioner Fisher, please continue.
Moving to slide 16, you can see in the more recent past with the unfunded liability. The only thing I would just highlight, in 2014, the decline that you see there is associated with again, it goes to this practice of smoothing assets, and we took all of the gains that had been historically smoothed, and in anticipation of the $3 billion contribution, we recognized all of those gains in 2014, and then the decrease between 2014 and 2015 is associated with that $3 billion contribution. That should not be viewed as a trend, consistent with the conversations we've been having starting in 2015 going forward. Then we expect that that unfunded liability will actually grow. Slide 617 we've discussed. If there aren't questions, I will move on. Slide 18 shows the history of the funding ratio over time, and this is where, as the chair acknowledged previously, between the years of 1996 through about 2001, at least based on actuarial assumptions, the fund was overvalued, or had an excess, I shouldn't say overvalued, had an excess of assets over liabilities. I think that between some adjustments to actuarial assumptions combined with changes in market conditions, then you see a fairly substantial drop between 2001 and 2002, which has kind of played out in the more recent past.
Commissioner Fisher, on that slide, if we look back in Alaska's history in 1979, and I won't say where I was in 1979, but when we look back, we were significantly underfunded at that point. Was that purely inflation and returns that moved us upward to a fully funded plan? Was there a change in contributions, or what activity did the legislators and the delegation of that time do to positively impact the unfunded liability?
I'll have to get back to you. I know this was associated with some fairly strong market returns during that period, but whether or not the state also took action, I'll have to get back to respond to that question.
If you do, or when you do, if you could also give us the employee count and whether there was a trend in expanded employees, because that has been an assertion from those that benefit from the defined benefit plan, that more active employees in the plan help pull you out of it based on their contributions. So
okay.
It would be helpful to have that population number, too, as far as employees. Please continue.
Thank you. On slide 19, you see a similar graph. It's not quite the same, but you see some periods in 99 and the year 2000 where we were at or above being fully funded, and you see a similar decline over time. Slide 20, this just shows kind of the history of how we arrived at the state assistance, the practice of the state contributing. Back in 2007-2008, particularly if you look at the TERS side, it was forecasted that the employer contribution would be going from the mid-20s to the mid-50%. And what that means is that for every, had it gone to the mid-50s, for every dollar that you paid to a teacher, you would make a 55-cent contribution into this fund. And I think that many school districts were faced a fairly significant challenge with that, and so the legislature made a decision to cap the employer contribution at 22% and the under the PERS plan, and the employer contribution about 12.5% under the TERS plan.
Senator Machicki.
I'm not sure how to learn the most about the discussions that occurred at the time. And I used to be a mayor of a small town in Soldotna, and I understand these relationships. But with the state never included in this discussion is the control the state has or the feedback the state has on the number of municipal employees, right? So a municipality, we are, through the years of taking on that responsibility of the contribution above 22%. However, they can add any employee that they wish, and we take on that unfunded liability. I'm kind of wondering if that was a part of the discussion back when that decision was made, because the state has no control of those costs, and the state still has no control of those costs. So if a municipality becomes wildly successful on some sort of, say, sales tax from out-of-state commerce that comes into the state, I'm just throwing out an example, and they decide they need hundreds and hundreds of new employees because of that success in that local municipality, the state would take on the liability from those employees and has no way to control that. I think that's something we're going to have to think about.
Senator Michicki, we talked about that under the school debt reimbursement, that municipalities were accessing debt service and that the state could not control it, and we placed a moratorium on it. So I think it's an insightful comment as to the structure and the support that we've provided municipalities without any strings attached that are causing the state an additional financial burden at this time. Commissioner Fisher.
The other point I would make is that this is largely a question of the past. In other words, now that we're in a tier four and a defined contribution, as if a municipality were to ramp up, in some respects that would actually help the system, because they would then be making a 22% contribution into this fund that helped address the unfunded liability. So in the past, you're right, but now that we're in, that all new employees are in a defined contribution category, they don't impact the potential expenses of this fund we're talking about.
Commissioner Fisher, except if you go back to the page where you gave us the amount of people sitting under the old system, I think it was 5,800 people. I'm trying to 5,200 people. If I'm looking at PERS, I'm sorry, I want to see PERS. If I'm back on slide 5, and we have 5,800 terminated employees that are entitled to future benefits.
Madam Chair, you're correct. If the city rehires one of those 5,800, then there's an opportunity that the liability does grow. That's correct.
Right. But it would be discriminatory for that employee for us to do something about it, because then the employer would have to know that would be a decision in hiring. I would think that would be a liability to the state, just to even try to go backwards. But on that conversation, Senator Michicki, do you want to – I'll let you respond on that first.
What? Actually, in my legislative career, I've kind of made a practice of hiring tier one retired employees. I'm not sure that's true. I don't think they have any impact on the benefits to the state once they're actually retired as a tier one employee. Isn't that correct?
Forgive me. What I intended to say is, if you hire, let's say, a tier three employee that has 15 years of service left and now wants to come back, by bringing them in, they still are entitled to those tier three benefits, and they grow the longer that they are state employees. And so in that, I think my comment to your original question was that I kind of operated with the assumption that the new employees would be tier four, and the chair just is reminding me that that's not necessarily true, that some subset of them could be within the defined benefit program, and then my statement wouldn't have been completely accurate.
Senator Vanahemoff.
Okay, just so I understand, taking this slide here, the active defined contribution of 19,377 people, and then flipping to slide 20. So of those active is the state paying any of the blue or green underneath the red line?
Yes, but let me kind of explain. The rate that you see on the page is the true cost to deliver the defined benefit plan to the members, the state employees, or the PERS members that are defined benefit members. However, the way the plan is structured is that I'm a Tier 4 employee. I don't participate in those benefits, but the state makes a 22% contribution on my behalf. Roughly, not exactly, but roughly half of that contribution goes and is part of my retirement. It's a defined contribution plan, and it goes into an account that I can manage like a 401k, and roughly half of it then goes to pay this past service amount.
So, Senator Von Hemma.
Through the chair, what's the shaded blue area?
The shaded blue area represents maybe I didn't understand your question exactly. The shaded blue area represents the state assistance payment. That's the difference between what the employer is paying for us, the 22% I described, and the true cost that is required to keep the plan solvent.
So do we pay any of that for the 19,377 people?
The state assistance payment is not calculated on a per employee basis. It is just when the ARM board and the actuaries figure out what is required, and then they look at the contribution, which is the solid blue line that is made by each employer, the state picks up the difference. And it's not tied to whether the state has employed Tier 1 or Tier 2. Or defined benefit or defined contribution.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Okay, this will be the last question, okay? So I'm dovetailing from Senator Michicki's comment. If municipalities have a gangbuster year and hire many employees, will the amount of blue shaded that the state has to pay, will that increase because the overall calculation of going into the plan increases?
It depends on the nature of the employees that they hire. If they were to hire 100% Tier 4, then the blue line would actually shrink because there would be more employees that were making that for whom the employer was making a 22% contribution. The plan would be more solvent, and so the state's on behalf payment would actually decline. If they were to hire 100% defined benefit employees, then that blue line, that shaded area would probably grow. On average, I think what we're seeing in that slide 5 is that increasingly our newer employees tend to be Tier 4. And so on average, I would think that if a municipality hired a bunch of people, that the blue line, the shaded portion would actually decline. But we can run some scenarios and...
Commissioner Fisher, is it fair to say that that's why the administration has been focusing on health care costs and trying to limit the growth on health care costs? Because, in effect, with this blended pension system, that's the one criteria that we can actually control costs to try to reduce the blue to the state of Alaska in contributions. And so, as an example, I receive benefits for health care from my state employment, and there's no longer a third plan available. I think it was called Deluxe. Tell me if it's right. I'm not sure that other people would think it's Deluxe compared to other packages, but as an employee, I could take money from my paycheck and pay hundreds of dollars more to acquire 80% or specific coverage on certain items. Is that why we're trying to control health care costs from an administrative perspective as much as we are? Commissioner.
Madam Chair, yes. So as I mentioned earlier, the retirees have a right. The state has a constitutional obligation to continue to provide a set of benefits to them. On the pension side, those benefits are pretty well defined and very difficult for us to change. On the health care side, they're defined not by the dollars we spend, but by the benefit we deliver to them. And so if we can work to deliver the same benefit at a lower cost, then that saves the plan money and helps minimize that unfunded liability. It's a. In addition, obviously, you know that we have an active active employee plan, and that is where we had kind of an economy, a standard, and a premium plan, and we're also working to try to minimize those costs as well.
Thank you, Commissioner. I have a series of questions that may be pointed. The administration does have let me step back. We can't go back and change benefits. Period. Courts in Alaska have ruled that they're protected constitutionally, both on the pension side of the house and the health in Alaska courts. Is that accurate?
Yes, Madam Chair.
We have employees that are worth their weight in gold or platinum. Is it true that employees' high 3 years of earning, based on being tier one, tier two, or tier three, may pull from the pension at a greater level based on those high three instead of the total life of their earnings?
Yes, and it varies depending on kind of the category and the tier. Our tier one, it's the high three. Tier three, it's actually high five, except for police and fire. So it varies, but the basic concept is accurate that their retirement is based on the last few years of their service.
So here comes the pointed question. Is the administration trying to control overtime costs by making sure that we're using lower cost people for overtime? Or do the work rules that you've adopted inside of the contracts allow senior police officers or electricians, whoever the state employee is, under work rules, do they have first bid at overtime? And if so, isn't that a measure that the administration could control?
Madam Chair, I've got to confess, I would have to remind myself of all those work rules. But as a general principle, I think you're right. We obviously have control over state employees, but as you've alluded to, 40-plus percent of the members of PERS are not state employees. I think as a general matter, we work hard to try to control overtime across the board in all of our categories. But I think there is an opportunity for people to take assignments that have more premium pay of one sort or another during those final years as a way of trying to bump up their retirement benefit.
Thank you. So I'd like to continue. I'd like the administration to review some of the policies related to the use of overtime and transferring from one agency to the next to get assignments that have cost of living or cost of living differentials to drive up the pensions at the end of their life. And I'm not trying to dissuade long-standing employees. I'm just saying that I'll give one example of someone who may work for 10 years as an elected official on a school board that makes a few thousand dollars a year, and then maybe is elected governor of the state of Alaska and jumps from the 2,000 to $125,000 a year. One term of office creates, depending on the tier, and this is not real for the people of Alaska, at least not to my knowledge. I'm trying to give an extreme case that would be retiring based on then 14 years of service at $125,000 a year, and then, I don't know, is that like 25 or 30%? I don't know the exact numbers. I haven't looked into retirement to know, but they're going to get, instead of whatever the right percentage is, if it's for round numbers, say 30% of their wage, instead of getting 30% of the 10 years at 2,000 and the 30% at 4 years at 125,000, they're getting all life of the loan. And so we have control on that, but in a sense we don't under Tier 1, Tier 2, and Tier 3. Is that accurate?
Madam Chair, that is accurate. The control we have is to, as you've alluded to, when we control those overtime or other premium pay, that's where we can control it. We cannot change the terms of the plan at this point.
So two more questions. The second and the last question is, have we also adopted different retirement periods? And I think the answer is yes, but I believe for police and fire, there's a 20-year to retirement, and so there's a much longer period that the state pays for benefits than the state receives in contributions. Is that accurate?
That is correct.
And so we've made those selections in state statute. We support our law enforcement officers and firefighters. We know they put their lives on the line on behalf of the people of Alaska, and that's why we've defined the term and the length of their employment in those ways. But that is affecting the unfunded liability. I just want to point that out. I'll pass, and I'll take any other questions. Senator Machicki?
So obviously we have some exposure, right? I mean, we showed that other chart, and that chart is depending on an 8% return. I'll just pick the year 2039. If we have a 7% return, that $800 million increases to $2.5 billion. If we have a 6% return, it increases to $3.5 billion. If we have a 5% return, it increases to $4.5 billion. Rough numbers from yesterday, right? Is the administration compiling a list of things that we should consider to reduce potential future liability to the state in all of the different things? I mean, we're hitting on some of them now, but what we really need is a comprehensive approach. And we want the employees of the state of Alaska, who are valued employees, to have competitive options for retirement, but we still must process a comprehensive list of options that controls that liability in the future. Is that something that you're working on, or something that we should, as the Senate Finance Committee, request that the Department of Administration work on for some tools for us to consider?
Through the chair, I would be pleased to work together to think about the options. I guess I want to make clear that this liability, to a large extent, is defined by the commitments we've made in the past that we can no longer change, and then other factors which are beyond our control, such as what the actual mortality is going to be of this group of people, and what the return assumption will be, and, you know, some of these factors. There might be an option to consider a retiree buyout. Those have had mixed success. There may be a few other options, but we are fairly limited in our ability to redefine the package that we're offering to the retirees based on what the commitments we've made and the limitation in the Constitution. So that is one of the reasons, as Madam Chair referred to, that we do focus a lot of energy around health care costs, because that is one where we believe we can continue to meet our obligations to the retirees while reducing the cost of delivering that service.
Senator Machicki?
I'll just give one option. I know about the constitutional requirement that we don't diminish benefits to retirees, but one is, when a Tier 1 through 3 employee returns to work, they have the option of either remaining retired or giving up their pension and earning additional benefits. So perhaps an option is, once you're retired, or you're retired, therefore you wouldn't be diminishing the benefits of a retired individual. That's kind of an example of something to consider, and a list of those options would be something. Certainly, Senator Peter Machicki intends to follow that requirement in our Constitution that we don't diminish existing benefits, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't consider all of the options on future liabilities.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Olson, followed by Senator Bishop.
Commissioner Fisher, I guess I would want to just confirm that as we look at some of the employees that are out there, especially the 5,835 or so that are terminated, that are not getting any benefits, and those, and if they do come back, they do continue to increase their benefits. Is that correct?
If I, through the chair, if I understand the question, yes. If they return to work and have more years of service, then their benefit will increase.
My last question, Madam Chair, has to do completely with something different, and it's outside of the PERS and TERS situation. And I want to know what the mentality is like within the administration, especially as you look at other retirement systems that are out there that are state employees, for example, the judges. Is the thought within the administration to go ahead and try and cut down on some of the expenses? Are they considering revamping those retirement systems as well to try and make it or put them in line so we're all under one retirement program?
Through the chair, we have not, if the question specifically is, have we considered changing jurors to creating a new tier of jurors, we have not modeled that, but that's something we could do.
Would the administration be opposed to it?
I don't know that we've processed that at this stage.
No further question, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Senator Bishop.
Yes, great discussion this morning, and there's no doubt that we're all concerned about trying to get to the same place at the end of the day. Yeah, great discussion. But on that, with that opening, you know, given that PERS and TERS are managing a system that is for current employees, would there be value to separating out the functions and missions of the board that looks at the interest of the members who are retired, and specifically taking a good hard look at bringing the retired public employees board back? I know you've had some discussion about that, and I've been meeting with my folks in Fairbanks, and I just want to get that on the record, and I know that those discussions are ongoing, but I just want it to be part of the public record that we continue to look at this option.
So through the chair, we have been having conversations with the retirees, and it's our intention to adopt relatively soon, and by that I mean certainly within the period of this legislative session, regulations that would establish a advisory board of retirees to give us advice and help us make choices around the healthcare benefits in particular. One of the things that we can do, consistent with the Supreme Court opinions, is we can change the nature of the plans as long as we, you know, if we take from one place and offer a benefit someplace else, then we can do that. And we want to work with the retirees to think about those changes so that we have their input as we move forward. And so I support the idea of doing it, and we've been having conversations, and I'm hopeful, optimistic, that we'll make that happen in the next short period of time.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Bishop. Senator Von Imhoff, did I miss you? Did you have a question? Thank you. Commissioner, please continue.
We just have two slides, and really I'll kind of do them together. This shows the projected retirement population growth. That end date of 2036 is when the plan projects that the last person will retire. And so you see there's kind of a little hump in kind of between the years of 2026 and 2028 when we peak. And then the next slide, slide 22, you see how that is translated in terms of benefits paid over the next many years. And so you see that over the next 70 years, there's $140 billion of benefits that will be paid. They kind of peak in the year 2039 and then begin to decline. And I think that's the end of our prepared slides, but we're happy to take any questions.
Senator Machicki.
Can you go back a slide? It's just a kind of interesting question. Is that lump of benefit risk marketable?
You mean, could we go to a third party and ask them to take that risk?
So what they would be gambling upon, of course, is that the actual exposures are somewhat lower than that curve, right? So there's potentially some marketability. Is that something worth processing and considering?
Well, I will say we have not considered it. We have not attempted to go out and see whether someone would take this risk. I think that to me, the answer to that question would largely depend on whether or not we thought someone else could manage the money better than we can and achieve a better return than we can. Because they are, in addition to, there is an opportunity this could be lower, but there's also a risk that it could be higher. And generally, third parties want to be compensated for taking that risk. And so I would think that unless you believe that a third party could generate a better return, then I think it would be hard to come out ahead. And generally speaking, I think that we've done a good job. I think that generally we would say, and our consultants would say, that the plan has been well managed, and I think we've enjoyed good returns. So, but if that's something the legislature would like us to consider, we can kind of ask.
Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Commissioner. I think there's a combination of considerations on reducing that risk. One is better returns. The other is managed care to bring down the health care cost and retirement costs of that. So I think there are combinations of risk to consider, and I just don't know if that's a product that's been out there yet, but it may be a worthwhile consideration.
Through the chair, I am not aware of someone who is in the position to assume both the financial risk and returns associated with this set of assets, and to effectively manage the healthcare costs. Those tend to be different kinds of organizations, but it's something we can examine more if we want to.
Thank you, Commissioner Fisher. On the brainstorming note, some large foundation who is marketing benefits, basically, to improve healthcare costs might be interested in a pilot program. Alaska has a low population, so there are trusts out there that are trying to create a market for buying improved healthcare outcomes. If I could add, there's another possibility, and that is pension buyouts. And so I believe there's a bill introduced somewhere in the legislature right now that's talking about early retirement and buyouts. And so if you could think about that for a moment, Senator Machicki, as a follow-up.
All right. Just Commissioner Fisher, you're an amazing man. I'm hoping you're not becoming somewhat institutionalized or bureaucratic, because I've seen you think way outside of the box. This is a little outside of the box, but I think there are many states in this situation. I'm not sure that there's not a product here that is not marketable with a series of factors that someone can deliver a better result across a wide range of outcomes, something that we're likely not equipped to do. So
I'll repent
Commissioner Fisher, do you have a response on the buyout? And I know that will need much more vetting, possibly from the administration's perspective, but it is one way that at least one legislator is suggesting could control costs. I know that there will be a variety of debate around that issue.
Madam Chair, I don't have a studied response. We have looked at that at a kind of a gross level, and what you see is a range of successes in the marketplace. The risk tends to be designing the program appropriately so you don't have selection bias, meaning that those who tend to have a low life expectancy would tend to take the buyout, and those who tend to have an expectation of a longer life expectancy would not. And I think there's getting the formula right has caused different experience success in leveraging those. So it's something we have not studied carefully, but again, I appreciate the nudging that I've received today, and we will be more proactive in kind of thinking and try to come back with a set of options and a more studied consideration of the likelihood of success.
Senator Dunleavy.
Just through the chair, just to build on what Senator Machicki said, and it's not directed at you, Commissioner. I happen to agree with the Senator's characterization of yourself, but this is for the entire administration. It gets somewhat frustrating because this is the time to think out of the box. I mean, if we put people on the moon in the 60s, and I just don't know if we're really reaching deep enough to come up with some ideas and some ways to reduce the size of this government and the size of the spend. It seems like we are being directed in the conversation to revenue enhancements, and I'll just get to the point. And I think I'm looking at the graph like the senator is, and I'm saying we've talked about a bill 2 or 3 years ago to pool insurance. I think there are outfits out there that would take a look at that. And it's not just you, but this is for the record. Some of us are going to be very, 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 very hesitant to leap into revenue enhancements, i.e. taxes, until we are convinced that the administration has exhausted every single possibility, has turned every single stone over to try and address this deficit through these types of approaches. And what some of us are getting is we can't do it anymore, not from you, but we can't do it anymore. We've reached our limit of imagination, and it's just physically impossible, and we just can't do it. And it's somewhat frustrating because really what we're getting down to now is just the discussion is, well, what are we going to tax our people and how much? And I just wish there was more of a attempt at exhausting all of our collective imagination and how we can reduce the size of government before we go and take people money out of the pockets of Alaskans. Just a bit frustrating. It's not you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I just want to say I can't speak for others. I think speak for our department. We have a fairly long list of initiatives that are underway, whether it's the shared service initiative, whether it's doing the work with the IT integration, whether it's focused on healthcare costs. I mean, and we have tried to prioritize those activities that we believe are have the greatest likelihood of returning a benefit to the state. I think I'd be delighted to come, whether it's in a public session or more private, and kind of go through the list and consider together whether we've prioritized it appropriately and are focused on the right things. But I do feel like, for my department, we kind of have, I think we're at risk of not being able to achieve the things we've taken on, more than having excess capacity that can think about additional things. And that probably sounds like an excuse, and I don't mean it to be. But I think we have taken on a lot of initiatives that are starting to bear fruit. I think they were the right things to do. I think they have an opportunity to change the way the state does government. So I'm pleased by that, and if we got it wrong, then let's have that conversation. And I don't in any way mean to suggest that we shouldn't, but I do think we're working hard based on a set of initiatives that we have taken on.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Von Amhoff, do you have a question?
Madam Chair, I have a question.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Fisher, as you look at some of the graphs there, and maybe I've missed it, but as we look at, we're drilling down on healthcare costs that are out there. The question I have is, as people reach age 65, they're required to go on Medicare. I don't see the reflection in the graphs that are there. Maybe I missed it.
Well, we didn't have a graph that called that out. But this plan assumes that when a person turns 65, mm-hmm. we become secondary to Medicare, and so our plan is by definition we will only fund the difference between what Medicare and the way the plan provides. But notwithstanding that most of our healthcare spend is between retirement and age 65, and the retiree plan is spending about $500 million a year on healthcare, and so that it is still a large issue.
And after 65, it's
The 500 includes everything. It includes the before and after. I don't recall exactly where the split is, but the majority of the cost is associated with that period, the pre-Medicare period.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Commissioner, in our contracts that you negotiate on behalf of the state, are there reopener clauses?
Generally, I'm not aware. I'd have to check, but I'm not aware of any reopener clauses in our contracts.
So there's not a mutual benefit if something happens that you can go back and ask a union to come to the bargaining table and open the contract?
We can always ask. We can always invite them, but they don't have an obligation. A typical reopener, we kicked around, I think it was two sessions ago, perhaps under certain situations there might be concessions granted, and then if oil prices reached a certain level, then certain things would happen. And we ended up not coming to any agreement on those. But having a defined event and an obligation for both sides to reopen the contract, I'm not aware of any of those. But we can always come to the a union and say we'd like to renegotiate.
Is that standard? Best practices for an employment contract?
My experience, both in the private sector and here, is that reopener clauses are quite unusual.
Thank you. Okay. So an extreme idea would be to go to the people of Alaska under its constitution and ask to streamline health benefits as a constitutional amendment and have retirees' health benefits mirror whatever was being provided for the current working folks in the state of Alaska. Again, we're trying to provide competitive rates, but that would be one out of the box, in the ballot box idea. Another one, Commissioner, and again, this is brainstorming about a $6 billion revenue shortfall that could Senator Michicki, what was the number? Based on rates of return, go up to $12 or $30 billion, depending on the rate of return for the asset allocation.
Madam Chair, collectively, the difference could be tens of billions of dollars.
Thank you, Senator Michicki. The administration, not through your shop, Commissioner, was starting to evaluate the use of pension obligation bonds. So another out-of-the-box idea might be to go to the munis, who have 40% of the responsibility, and come together on a cash infusion for the plan to buy them out, not necessarily us taking on pension obligation bonds, but them, if they wanted to buy out of the longevity of their term, giving us a cash up front. So, again, a conversation where they can get out from under possibly some of their debt by infusing some cash into the plan to reduce their future obligation. So just, again, quickly brainstorming. I'm sure there's some challenges to all of those, but just trying to put ideas on the table from a layman's perspective. Any additional comments for the presentation on PERS and TERS? Unfunded liability? Anything else to come before the committee? Commissioner Fisher, thank you for your presentation today and joining us in Senate Finance. Mr. Kevin Worley, thank you for joining us. You've been rather quiet, so I hope that it's been a positive experience. Maybe next time we can have a few questions for you. On tomorrow's agenda, I'm sorry, there is no agenda tomorrow. On Monday's agenda, we'll be taking up SB 30. It's a bill, the approval of royalty oil sales to PetroStar, and SB 39, Muni Energy Improvement Assessment Bonds. So if the senators would please review those documents. I plan to hear them, open the public hearing if time allows, and then hold them for at least one day, just so that senators have time to take a look and make sure that they're comfortable with that, those pieces of legislation. So, Commissioner, thank you. With that, it's 10:49, and we're adjourned.